Well, why don't we get started, and we'll welcome the Surgeon General in just a minute. My name is Paul Jarris. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, or ASTO. Today I'll be introducing our speakers and moderating the question and answers. We are going to have two parts to this discussion, and each part will have question and answers. So you will have an opportunity to interact with the Surgeon General in the first part, where we'll be talking Dr. Ellinger and Dr. Murthy. We'll be talking about federal and state learnings about how to overcome barriers and work across sectors to achieve health equity and engage communities. And then we'll have a Q&A at that point. Following that, the second half of the session will highlight unique public health partnerships that leverage the expertise of financial institutions. And we have someone here from the Federal Reserve of Chicago, and Dr. Ellinger will be, and you all may engage the conversation at that point. So, you know, it's clear in looking at public health now that we get the idea of health and all policies, we get the idea of the importance of this, and in some ways we know we need to work with transportation, agriculture, education. One of the challenges we face, though, is our rhetoric is far ahead of our practice. And I think that's part of the gap we're trying to close here with these conversations, to learn who these different partners are, and how we can engage with them in taking a health, you know, policies approach. How can they further their interests in their sector, and at the same time do so in a way that can improve the health of the population we're serving. It also means we need to rethink our jobs in public health, and recognize that we aren't yet who we want to be. Whether that's our workforce, do we have the skills in our workforce to work across sectors? I think we'll hear some of these presentations and be asking ourselves, what was that acronym? Or I never heard of that term. Or I never knew the financial institutions did that kind of thing. We need to gain that expertise, clearly. We need those new partners. We need to develop strong relationships before there's a crisis or an issue. And we really need ways of engaging with communities. Importantly, also, I think we have to recognize these sectors have expertise we don't have. And we have to have a sense of humility when we go to the table to recognize we are there to learn and perhaps have an opportunity to teach other sectors. But clearly, very impressive what is going on elsewhere. Three things, I believe, or I'll say four things we need to do to transform public health. Again, we need to develop this expertise. You know, how many of us have people with a transportation background, an agricultural background, an education background, you name it, in our agencies? Very few of us have that expertise. Secondly, our funding in public health tends to be categorical, by disease, by condition. This work is not categorical work. It's engagement in health and all policies across sectors. We don't have a financial model for that yet in public health. Legitimacy is important for those of us in governmental public health. You have to have a mandate or a reason to be at the table. You don't want to get the question call, in the case of a health official, from a chief of staff saying, what are you doing over in agriculture today? Or why are you going to that transportation meeting? We have to create that legitimacy that public health has a role at those tables, and more importantly, that we add value to those other sectors and other tables. And then we think about data and information systems. We know that within public health ourselves, we have all these fragmented data systems that often don't talk to each other. We can't extract the information. Imagine how much more complex that becomes when we start interacting with data systems that other sectors have, which can be so important to the work we're doing. So there are, hang on while I break this. Session objectives today, we really want to discuss strategies for achieving health equity through a health and all policies approach. And the particular emphasis I want to say here that Dr. Ellinger is putting, as you'll hear from him, is really how do we create health equity through this all sectors approach, as well as health for the overall population, both things. And identify ways that as a system, federal, state, local policymakers and community policymakers can really explain a narrative about what creates health. So as important as healthcare is, we can move a little bit outside the bounds of just healthcare. And then define the public health challenges we're facing when working across sectors. So I think, again, you'll find this to be a stimulating conversation. We're a small enough group that we can have some good exchange. So it is now truly my pleasure and honor to introduce Vice Admiral Vivek Murthy. He currently serves as a 19th U.S. Surgeon General. He's responsible for communicating the best available scientific information to the public regarding ways to improve personal and public health. And he also oversees the operations of the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, who's had a very active year and a half or 2 years, and we thank you for that. Dr. Murthy earned his bachelor's degree from Harvard, his MD and MBA degrees from Yale, and he completed his residency training at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, where he later joined the faculty as internal medicine physician instructor. When he was 17 years old, Dr. Murthy and his sister co-founded Visions, which was an HIV/AIDS education program in India and the U.S., which he led for 8 years. He also co-founded the Svastha. You gotta tell me how to say it. Sorry, you'll tell us. Svasthya Project, a community health partnership in rural India designed to train women to be health providers and educators. Dr. Murthy also has conducted research on vaccine development and studied the participation of women and minorities in clinical trials. He is a healthcare entrepreneur who launched a successful software technology company, Trial Networks, to improve research collaboration and enhance the efficiency of clinical trials around the world. Most recently, he served as president of Doctors for America, a nonprofit organization comprised of more than 16,000 physicians and medical students in all 50 states who work with patients and policymakers to build high-quality, affordable healthcare systems for all. And after all that, there was only one thing left to do, and that was to become the Surgeon General, right? So Dr. Ellinger has served as the Minnesota Commissioner of Health since January 2011, where he's responsible for directing the work of the Minnesota Department of Health, the state's lead public health agency. He's responsible for protecting, maintaining, and improving the health of all Minnesotans. Dr. Ellinger oversees the work of 1,400 health department employees in the Twin Cities areas and 7 offices in greater Minnesota. Prior to being appointed commissioner, Dr. Ellinger served as director and chief health officer for Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota and an adjunct professor in the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. He has a BA and MD from University of Wisconsin, his master's in Madison, and a master's of science in public health from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The most impressive thing, though, about Dr. Ellinger is he was the first recipient of the City Match Ed Ellinger Award. So, for the great work he did in that organization. So, Dr. Murthy.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Jarrett, for that introduction, and to all of you for your warm welcome. I'm a little under the weather today, so if I don't shake your hand after the ceremony, it's not because I'm rude, it's just because I'm trying to be a good public health person. So I apologize for that in advance. As Dr. Jarrett mentioned, I've had the great privilege of wearing a number of different hats over the years. I've had the chance to teach at an academic hospital, to care for patients, which has been the best part of my career. I've had the chance to build nonprofit organizations and companies. But doing all of that, I should say, what I've learned over the last few months, having had the chance to meet state and health officials from across the country, is that I've realized that your job is a lot harder than any of the jobs that I've had, because you're really where the rubber meets the road. You have a number of important principles and practices that you are thinking about implementing across the state, but you have to work on the ground with folks overcoming barriers that all of us are going to talk about today. Actually translate those ideas into something real, something that can touch people's lives and improve their health for the better. That is difficult work. It is work that often doesn't get the thanks that it requires. But I just want you to know how much I recognize the importance of what you do and how much I appreciate it. So first, just to thank you for that. I also have been thinking a little bit today and in coming over to ask though about what this work is really all about that we do. Because we know it's about health. We know it's about ensuring that people not only get the treatment they need when they're sick, but that we prevent illness before it even happens. But I've also been reflecting on the fact that this is about a lot more than just health. Because health in the end is a means to an end. And the question is, what is that end? And that end is the chance for people to pursue lives that will ultimately be satisfying, meaningful, and that will bring them happiness. And that's what health is. It's a key that opens doors of opportunity. It's the foundation on which we can stand as we pursue our dreams, as we reach for our vision of how we may want to live our life or what we may want to build for our family. And that context is really important. It's actually very directly related to what we're going to talk about today, which is building health into all policies. Because one of the most important things that we have to do to move other sectors to understand the importance of health is we have to help them see how their objectives are very much connected to and dependent on health. And this is something that's obvious to all of us, but it's not so obvious to people out there in the field. And, you know, I had some remarks here prepared to share with you, but if you don't mind, I might just speak, just talk to you directly and share what's on my mind. You know, when I travel around the country, there are a lot of people that I meet who want us to get to a place where we have health in all our policies, who recognize that their housing, their transportation, their infrastructure has a direct impact on the health outcomes in their community. But they feel stuck. They don't know how to convince other people of that. As one group put it to me when I was doing a listening session, they said, you know, we're sitting next to people who we should be collaborating with, but we're forced to compete with them because of how funding is set up. And that's not just true within government, but it's true outside of government as we look at philanthropy, which so often is set up to fund in the old traditional ways, funding diabetes research, funding cardiovascular projects, as opposed to funding more upstream projects that address the challenges that ultimately all of our sectors face together. So these are real challenges that folks face on the ground. So on the one hand, we have to help people understand that we will only achieve good health by building health into all of our policies and acknowledging it. But on the other hand, we have to figure out how to speak the language of folks in other sectors, of how to make the case, both the moral case and the business case, that investing in health, even if you're not in a health-related sector, makes sense, that it's the right thing to do and that it's the smart thing to do. This is really the challenge that we have. But I'll say that I'm hopeful that we can do this because I think that there are several things that are pushing us in the right direction. One is a shift that we are seeing in payment models. We're increasingly seeing more and more of a shift, particularly in the public sector, but also in the private sector, to rewarding and paying for value and outcomes as opposed to the traditional fee-for-service model. And I can't underestimate how, or rather overestimate how important this is in shifting what we do. You know, before I remember one of the hospitals that I had worked in before I became Surgeon General had been talking about improving our EMR system for years. But it was only when we actually shifted our payment model and started becoming part of a shared savings model that we saw those changes accelerate, because we realized that we needed to have them to track the metrics we needed to track, to reduce readmissions, and ultimately to provide the high-quality care that we want every hospital to provide in this country. Similarly, I find more hospitals as I travel around the country thinking and talking about prevention. Even though in the old days that was against their business model, in the new day, it's actually consistent with their business model to think about how to keep people healthy and keep them out of the hospital. I think this is a trend that's just in its nascent phase. But as our secretary and as the president announced some months ago, their plans to try to shift Medicare payments to almost 80% in the value-based category, I think we're going to see private insurers follow suit. And that will really change the game in terms of who's thinking about community-based prevention. So that gives me hope that we're seeing that we have changing payment models that are pushing us in that direction. But the other thing that's pushing us in that direction, I think, are real stories of success. Stories from Georgia, from Minnesota, where Dr. Erlinger is from many other states, which are showing us that when sectors actually do come together, that incredible things can happen. And you know, just I shared yesterday the story of West Wabasso, Florida, where the city of West Wabasso in Indian River County decided some years ago that they were going to invest in proper lighting, in building sidewalks, in building bike paths, in cleaning up vacant lots so that they could ultimately build parks that people could spend time in, as opposed to having spaces that people were afraid of traveling in. And what they found is that despite having a really challenged situation where half of the people live below the federal poverty line, they found that 2 years after making these changes, that over 95% of people increased their level of physical activity. 95%, that's pretty extraordinary. If you think about the number of public health interventions we have that impact 95% of people, that's they're far and few between. But when asked why they changed their activity levels, it was the reason most commonly stated was because there was greater availability of safe, walkable spaces in the community. Now, that community would not have made that investment if they didn't recognize that there was a connection between infrastructure and health. But they did, and incredible things happened as a result. So this is the second source of hope for me, is that we have more and more stories of success that show us that it is not only a good idea and feasible, but that it's necessary for sectors to come together to improve health. But what does all this mean for us? You know, I think that we all are here, and all of you are in the leadership positions you're in, because you know that your job, that our collective job, is not just to head up one sector, but increasingly now we are called upon to be conveners of sectors. That as opposed to being satisfied just to have a place at the table, there are times where we will have to convene the table to bring folks together to understand that there are some issues that we need to tackle collectively, and that it's in our best financial interest and it's consistent with our moral goals to tackle that together. And this is not simple work. It requires a re-education of not just others, but ourselves as well. As Paul mentioned, some of this is about learning a new language, a language that we may not be familiar with when it comes to terms that are used in transportation or that are used in the financial sector or in sectors that are traditionally disparate from health. And some of it is other people understanding our language. One thing I've recognized in these past 10 months being Surgeon General, being on the road, is that people look at health as a black box if they're not in it. They look at it as very complex, as difficult to understand. They respect health, but they often don't want to touch it because it seems sticky, complicated, and difficult. If they feel that way, then it's going to be more and more difficult for them to engage. And then that's why it becomes incumbent upon us to help other sectors see how they can get started when it comes to collaborating with health, when it comes to advancing our collective goals. So these are some of the challenges that we face. But I think that this provides an incredible leadership opportunity for public health. Because again, I don't think about us as just one of many sectors that has to be funded in silos or that has to be treated the way that we've been treated for the last several hundred years. But I see this as really the age of public health, the time when people are going to understand more and more, just as money is a consideration for every department, regardless of whether what you deal with. Health, too, should be a consideration for every sector, because in the way that finances affect everyone, so too does health. And the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we're able to communicate that to other sectors, the sooner we're able to help them understand how to take the first steps to collaborating and to improving health, then the more quickly, I believe, we can build the kind of society we all want, a society that's grounded in prevention, where everything that we do, from how we build our streets, to what we teach in our schools, to how we run our businesses, ultimately supports health. And finally, that's why I want to thank all of you again, because the work that you're doing is challenging work. It's not work which often has a great precedent for it, because the challenges that you are seeking to take on are challenges that your predecessors may not have encountered. The goals that you're seeking to achieve in terms of this cross-sector collaboration and building a culture of communication across sectors may not be something that your predecessors actually built or created. And this is as much about learning a new language and building collaborations as it is about culture change. Because that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to build a new culture within government. We're trying to build a new culture in our communities, recognizing that we can't pass enough policies alone to change to health on the, in the end. That health is a complex product of policies and culture. And as we often used to say when I was building my technology company and we were having these discussions about what kind of policies to put in place for employees and such, we often used to say, culture eats policy for lunch every day. Meaning that you can have the best policies in the world, but if people don't believe in them, if the cultural influences in their life are not consistent with your ultimate outcome, then it may not matter in the end. And that's why when I think about building a culture of prevention in America, one rooted in on the pillars of good nutrition, of emotional well-being, of physical activity, I recognize that we have to do more than providing time for kids to exercise in school. We have to do more than ensuring that affordable, nutritious options are available in neighborhoods. We could do more than ensuring that people can get mental health care when they're ill. And that more is that we have to change culture around those three. If we don't have a culture that values or pushes people toward healthier foods, then we can have as many healthy, affordable options as we want. No one's going to choose them. If we have all the mental health services in the world available, being reimbursed the way they should be, but the stigma related to mental illness is still so great that people don't feel comfortable talking about mental illness or coming forward to seek help, then we haven't achieved our goal. And if we build all the walkways in the world and have the safest bike paths in the country, but physical activity is seen as dull, uninteresting, boring, and a chore, then we're not going to get people to be physically active. And that's what makes our job so complex and also so interesting, is that we are not only seeking to change policy, we are not only seeking to ensure that all sectors come together around health, but we're asking that incredibly complex question that public health has asked for generations, which is, how do we change culture? And ultimately, to succeed, that's what we're going to have to do. So I'm looking forward to discussing more of this here with you today. And just want to thank you again for the incredible work that you do at a very, very difficult and challenging time for public health, but one that I also think is filled with great opportunities, opportunities that we are going to take advantage of in building up ultimately a stronger and healthier country. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Surgeon General, for those remarks. It is really great to be here on this panel with the Surgeon General. He has the ultimate bully pulpit in public health at the national level, and I have the bully pulpit in my state as Minnesota's health commissioner, and also the bully pulpit as the president of ASTO, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. And so I think that's one of the hope that we have a conversation about how, and it's part of what I'll be talking a little bit about, how we change that conversation about what creates health. Because leadership matters, how we use words matters, and I think we have some of the people in this room that can help do that. For those of you who know me, recognize that I understand that where we are today is really because of a lot of things that have gone before us, and that we're in a historical trajectory. So let me just start by saying 150 years ago, exactly, in 1865, Edward Prince of Wales dedicated the Abbey Mills pumping station, known as the Cathedral of Sewage. And it ended the cholera outbreak, finally. You know, we heard about John Snow and all the epidemiology and the Broad Street pump. But he had to work with Henry Whitehead, who was a minister in that area, who knew the population, who knew the community, who knew the socioeconomic conditions, to map all of that out, take away the pump handle. But then it became Joseph Boswell Gett's responsibility as engineer for the London Board of Health to put together the sewer system. That was dedicated 150 years ago. Then 100 years ago, you know, after, because they recognized the socioeconomic factors. Then 100 years ago, the Welsh Rose Report was published. 1915, which identified, that's really laid the basis for schools of public health, and recognized at that point in time that we needed to integrate medical care and public health in ways that had happened before but were starting to disintegrate, because they recognized that a broader array of approaches was really needed if we were going to create health.
And then 50 years ago, in 1965, the 89th Congress was convened. And the 89th Congress, arguably the most important or the most productive, the productive Congress ever. They had Head Start, Medicare and Medicaid, Neighborhood Health Centers, Food Stamps, Voting Rights Act, Job Corps, VISTA, Peace Corps, school, I mean, on and on and on. They really identified a health and all policies approach. And it was community-based and really made some huge progress. And I think from those three examples, we have similar situations today. We recognize there are huge socioeconomic factors affecting health throughout our country. Certainly we see those in our state and in all the states that I interact with. We also recognize the need to integrate medical care and public health in ways that we hadn't before. And we're really realizing the importance of a health in all policies approach. So after 150 years, 100 years, 50 years, we're at this point today where we really need to start learning from all of the messages of the past, all of the efforts of the past. But since the late 70s and early 80s, instead of taking those approaches, we've taken a different approach. We've invested in medical care at the expense of public health, the dollars, and so you've seen the cost rise on medical care at the same time that our longevity is slow, our improvements in longevity are slowing. We're losing ground related to other countries. Our infant mortality rates are starting to slow in terms of improvement, and we're losing ground compared to other countries. And our disparities have gone up. So we're really seeing some changes because we've had that approach, investing in medical care. And the other part of the common mantra about what creates health is that we've said it's about individual responsibility. You know, most people say that if everybody just had good medical care and made good personal choices about physical activity and nutrition and substance use, we'd be healthy. And that's where we've invested all of our resources and our approaches, and it really hasn't gotten us to where we really need to be. So as important as that is, as important as medical care is, and as important as personal choices are, it's insufficient. So I think the approaches that were taken back in 1865, in 1915, and 1965 are the approaches that we really need to take today. And that's why I put, as part of my president's challenge, so you've heard about the triple aim of health, you know, where you're focusing on improved cost, or reduced cost, and patient experience and population health. And that's really important. It's helped change the conversation about healthcare in a really a good way. But that by itself is insufficient because it talks about individuals sort of in isolation of the community in which they live. And as the Surgeon General said, it's the environment in which people live that really impacts their health. So we want, you know, the healthy choice to be the easy choice. Well, we want the healthy choice to be the possible choice. And healthcare, the way healthcare is set up, it sort of talks about the individual outside the context of his or her community. And as Wendell Berry, the poet, says, the community really needs to be the smallest measure of health, because looking at the health of an individual outside the context of their community is really an oxymoron. And so I put together what I, for my president's challenge, is this triple aim of health equity. And it really starts with expanding our understanding about what creates health. As important as medical care is and personal choice, that is not sufficient. That we really recognize that it's the environment in which people live. We recognize that it's the policies, it's the socioeconomic conditions, it's the educational level, it's the environment that's there. So we need to have that conversation. So that's why I think our bully pulpits are needed to change that narrative about what creates health. And as we change the narrative, it helps to change the culture in which we live, and it brings new partners to the table. We're certainly seeing that in Minnesota, where we've started to talk about what creates health, and we've gotten a lot of community organizations, as they were talking about building insurance, recognizing that minimum wage is also a health issue. Paid leave is a health issue. Complete streets is a health issue. And they're starting to see that as a way of organizing their work. So we bring new partners to the table. So the first part of this triple aim is expand our understanding about what creates health. The second is implement that health in all policies approach, but with health equity as the goal. We need to know that we recognize that, yes, we need transportation and housing and corrections and education, but they have to have health equity as a goal, because without that focus on health equity, it can lead to, for transportation or housing, gentrification, or for paid leave. You can increase the disparities. If only full-time workers get paid leave and part-time workers don't get paid leave, it actually can increase disparities. So we really have to have that health in all policies. And certainly in our state, where we've talked about health in all policies, I've systematically met with all of the commissioners in my governor's cabinet. Actually, I've had them on my TV show and had them on talking about health. And as they start talking about their role in health, they start to understand that they really have a huge role to play in creating health. And they're starting to say that they're putting a health lens and a health equity lens on all of the work that they do. It doesn't change what they do, but it changes how they do it. And finally, we have to strengthen the capacity of communities to create their own healthy future. This is where we really need to rearrange how we do our business. These are practices that we have to learn in public health if we're going to be the health strategist, if we're going to be the conveners, if we're going to really organize the communities and the professionals to move forward with a health and all policies approach. These are the practices, and that community capacity is where we see communities coming together to actually make change. So we've actually had communities come to the legislature and ask us, or ask the legislature to ask us in the health department to do a white paper on income and health, because they recognize that it's health. They ask us to do the job that we want to do, and that's one of the things. You know, we passed a minimum wage bill in Minnesota. For me, that's probably the greatest public health achievement that we've had in the 4 years that I've been health commissioner. And most people are starting to see that, because it increases life expectancy by 3.5 years if you can move somebody from the lowest quintile to the second lowest quintile of income. So this is the challenge that I'm giving to all state health officials. Embrace this triple aim of health equity. It changes how we do our work. It helps, but it needs transformational leadership skills. It helps us to become the health strategist, the health convener. And we're putting together some toolbox and work, toolbox and toolkits for people to do this. And we're also asking questions that can help lead the conversations in these areas. So we need the white papers, the data analytics that Paul was talking about. We need the policy analysis. We need the health impact assessments. We need to do all of these things in a new way, because I think from the history that we had, now is the time when people are understanding that we cannot continue to go the level we're going with the disparities. They're going in the wrong direction, and the efforts that we've had over the last 30 years are not making a difference. So we need to focus on social determinants of health. We need to focus on a health and all policies approach, and we need new partners. And I think I'll end by saying we need to go back to our roots. This is not, you know, people say, aren't you really taking this to new level? No, this is our root. This is the root of public health. As I go back to that Welch Rose report that put together Schools of Public Health, one of the people who commented on it was Abraham Flexner, who had developed the Flexner Report. And he said, the physician function is fast becoming social and preventive rather than individual and curative. Do not forget that directly or indirectly, disease has been found to depend largely on unpropitious environment, bad water supply, defective drainage, impure food, unfavorable occupational surroundings. These are matters for social regulation, and doctors have the duty to promote social conditions that conduce to physical well-being. Medical community back in the 1915s recognized that medicine had to be involved in addressing the conditions in which people can be healthy. At the same time, CEO Winslow, who was the dean of the School of Public Health at Yale at that time, had this definition of public health, and yes, it's the art and science of preventing and prolonging life and promoting health and all that thing. But he had ended with, it's the development of the social machinery to ensure everyone a standard of living adequate for the maintenance of health. So organizing these benefits as to enable every citizen to realize the birthright of health and longevity. So public health back then knew it. Medicine back then knew it. That is our role. If you look at the Institute of Medicine definition of public health, that's what we do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. And that's why we have to change the conversation. We have to change the narrative about what creates health, because it focuses on the conditions. And the conditions can then be addressed by a health and all policies approach. And that's why we have to have communities that are empowered to help make that happen. So that's our conversation that we have to have as the part of the bully pulpit. And later on, when Susan comes up to talk about those conditions, how we can get communities engaged in that. So I look forward to our conversation. Thank you.
I'm Ms. Susan Longworth, and I am indeed a business economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And I know when Dr. Erlinger asked me to be on this panel, I felt a little bit like that Sesame Street episode about sort of which one of these things does not belong. And so I sort of think of myself as a fruit among vegetables here. But hopefully, as I work through my remarks, that will my place in all of this, or sort of the Federal Reserve and the financial services sector's place in this discussion, will become a little bit more clear to you, and hopefully will lead to some very interesting discussions. So first of all, my disclaimer is that the opinions I express today are mine. They're not necessarily the opinions of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, the Federal Reserve System, or certainly not the Board of Governors in D.C. But what I do want to do is to introduce the Federal Reserve's approach to this space of health equity and the concept and how we think about it, and hopefully place that within a broader context of community development. And certainly I'm going to try and use the city of Chicago as an example. And that reminds me of the other thing I have to do is to welcome you to Chicago. You all hold some special powers over the weather. Because not only is it nice out, this is actually record-breaking temperature. So I think just for the next few days that you're in town, we will enjoy this lovely weather, and I hope that you get out to visit the city a little bit. Dr. Murphy's comments, you know, again, when we first set up this panel, I wasn't quite sure how this was all going to fit together, and yet it was with great relief that I noted that much of what he said, I think you will see, is a perfect segue into the second half of the conversation. So first of all, let me say a little bit about the Federal Reserve, because I think probably for many of you, you didn't expect to be thinking about that today. And as many of you know, the Federal Reserve is primarily responsible for setting monetary policy. And as our policy has two primary goals, one of maintaining price stability and the other of ensuring full employment. And without taking you back to your undergraduate macro class, those two things are often a little bit in conflict with each other. And so that leads to some of the discussions that are currently in the news regarding rate increases and things like that. So that's probably the context in which you're most familiar and you most frequently hear about the Federal Reserve. We are also, some people know, a bank regulator, and we work to ensure the safety and soundness of the United States financial system. And we have an extensive research function that informs both our policy setting and our supervisory roles, and that's sort of where I fit into the picture. Here, there are 12 reserve banks around the country. Here, we're in the 7th District. Chicago is the headquarters for the 7th District of the Federal Reserve. We serve all of Iowa, parts of Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan's Lower Peninsula. So therefore, we have a uniquely Midwestern footprint that is at the same time industrial and rural. So let's talk, we're narrowing things down a little bit, and we'll talk a little bit about community development at the Federal Reserve. We also, as part of our responsibilities, enforce the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA, as we call it. And just like all of you, we live in a world of acronyms, and so we'll work through some of those because there is some overlap. But anyway, CRA is a piece of legislation passed by Congress to combat redlining, which is discriminatory credit practices in low-income neighborhoods. I'm not going to get into CRA today. Certainly, if you or your organizations are interested in CRA, understanding how banks enforce CRA, how it plays out in your communities, we do offer trainings, and we are more than happy. There's lots of information that we could provide to you around this, but this is not that session. But primarily, what the CRA does is to ensure that banks lend into the communities from which they take their deposits. Every Federal Reserve Bank has a community development function designed to respond to the credit needs, issues, and priorities of the region that they serve. So we each function uniquely to a certain extent. And to ensure this is happening, we monitor what we call credit conditions. Credit conditions, in our interpretation, are things such as access to jobs. Is there affordable quality housing? Are there educational opportunities and certainly access to early child care opportunities? What are the general neighborhood conditions? Are property values increasing or decreasing? How are vacancies? What are the services provided? Is there general neighborhood stability? Is the neighborhood inclusive? What are the social services support? And certainly we also look at what are financial services available to residents in any given community. So if you listen to these, you should start to sound to you like the social determinants of health. And I hope that this would start to sound a little bit more comfortable to you. So in many ways, we are looking at the same things, but perhaps through a different lens. So to take this further into the Federal Reserve, I'm going to bring in a quote from our former Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, and this is something that he said at a recent system-wide community development research conference, in which he says that factors such as educational attainment, income, access to healthy food, and the safety of a neighborhood tend to correlate with individual health outcomes in that neighborhood. And what I think this illustrates, or should say to you, is that this thinking around so the social determinants of health and the linkages between community development and the social determinants are very much part of the sort of permeating and percolating the thinking of the Fed. And it started out of the Federal Reserve of San Francisco with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And here in the seventh district, our efforts have focused on convenings. And so as Dr. Murphy said earlier, was sort of a convening of sectors, the convener of sectors, I think that's a role that we feel very comfortable performing as well. So another area of complementarity. We hosted one of these convenings here in Chicago. And we're also part of a very interesting discussion in Milwaukee addressing this topic in the context of criminal justice. I think we are also the only Federal Reserve branch that has started to look at this within a rural or low-density context. And I know that our colleagues in Minneapolis are actually looking at how this plays out amongst Native populations. And this very afternoon, a discussion is happening in Detroit at the Detroit branch of the Federal Reserve around how this intersection plays out in depopulating urban environments. And so these are all areas in which we have a vested community development interest, and yet at the same time we want to think about the other partners that are also on the ground. So the reality is, as we see it, is that community development and public health fields have been working in the same places for decades, and that community development inputs often yield public health outcomes. So I'm going to move to... So to summarize, often the way we think about it, in community development, we focus on the areas that promote or enable health. Also, I imagine some of you would also think that we are some of our interventions deal with disease prevention, such as access to healthy foods, quality allergen-free housing, those types of interventions. Although the recognitions that this is what is actually going on is quite recent. So I'm going to turn now to an example specifically from Chicago, since that's where you are. Chicago is divided up into 77 distinct communities. These communities are often quite ethnically, racially, and economically, socioeconomically homogenous, and so they maintain distinct characteristics from each other. As you wander around Chicago and get lost, people will tell you that the lake is always east, which is an incredibly not useful thing to be told if you don't know where you are. But if you do look at those three maps, what you'll see, hold on, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Essentially what these are stoplight maps and playing out across three metrics, life expectancy, families in poverty, and educational attainment in terms of some college or a college degree. And you'll see that the communities that are highlighted in green are those that are significantly above the city mean. Those in yellow hover somewhere around that mean, and those in red are those that are significantly below. And you'll see also that the communities that are persistently in red are the same, and those are also areas within our cities on the south and west sides that have persistent pockets of poverty and racial isolation. So turning to the life expectancy map, there is a 16-year spread across the city of Chicago from a low of about 69 years to a high of 85 years. So if you look at that map far on the left, the community circle that's in red, that's West Garfield Park. And the community with the highest life expectancy is what we call the Near North Side, which is along the lake and is circled in green. And you'll see if your eyes can track across the three maps that those communities and the ones surrounding them remain persistently red or green and are sort of parts of pockets. So I doubt that any of this is a surprise to you, and in fact you've probably seen similar maps for other cities, or perhaps you've even constructed them for the places where you work. But what this does clearly illustrate is not only a strong association amongst these factors, but the potentially efforts to reduce poverty and increase opportunity, things that are at the very core of community development, will have measurable health outcomes. And therefore it follows, that these places, and data exists across several distinct variables, are places about which both the public health sectors and community development sectors care deeply, and we're working together, we can both affect measurable change. So where do we go from here? And these are the things that we, talking to my colleagues when they were sort of asking me why I was taking some time away from the bank today, things we talked about. And it's interesting to me that these have been echoed already by the other speakers. And so if we acknowledge that we work in many of the same areas and desire to have impact in the same places, what's next? What needs to happen? And I challenge us to think on both sides of the table to think very tangibly about what this means. So on the one hand, we just need to start talking to each other. I can attest this discussion is happening. Just a week ago here in Chicago, community development finance institutions, and I can talk more about what those are, met with the community benefits leaders at area hospitals to talk about how they can work together and what each brings to the table. So this is an example of sort of a tangible crossover that is happening. But sometimes we still get confused. Community development is also a world of acronyms. CDC means Community Development Corporation to us. I know it means something completely to you. A community benefits agreement means something completely different to us as well. And now you're using it in a new way. And so those are all conversations. And so that may seem simple or trivial, but the point that's been made earlier this morning is that it's an important step in having our two cultures working together. And finally, I would argue that perhaps the beginning of all this could perhaps be at the end, thinking about outcomes. And I think our two sectors think about success quite differently in how we measure change. The community development field, and specifically that aspect that deals with community finance, community development finance, which is where your financial institutions will come in, which is incidentally a $20 billion a year industry, is mission transactional. We move from deal to deal, and that's what we do. And while very skilled at managing and leveraging capital flows and capital stacks and all of those kinds of things, our end game is often measured in housing units, built, small business loan dollars repaid, childcare spots open. Our impact horizons rarely extend to the actual how our interventions impact or change the health of a place. How do we get to a place? So my argument to you would be this: how do we get to a place where those three maps I showed earlier are not each individual static conditions, but are actually reflect points along a continuum of change? So I'm going to stop the couple of websites here. First of all, that's my contact information, so feel free to use it. Our Chicago Fed website is there, and then the fedcommunities.org website is a portal into all of the community development work that is being done across the Federal Reserve System. So I know that many of you are from different places. I would encourage you to look at that and find out what the Fed is doing in your area and how you may be able to engage with them around this discussion. Thank you.
I'm just going to have a couple comments before I turn it back to Paul to open it up for questions. But you can see that community development and public health really are twins and joined at the hip in many ways. And a lot of the strategies that are used are really a health and all policy strategy. So we have good partners in the Federal Reserve Bank. Certainly we do in Minnesota, and I hope you do in your part of the country. But also it focuses on how you leverage these partnerships to do even more. Susan has agreed to be on an advisory committee for an approach that we're taking in the central or the Midwest with Big Ten universities. So the 11 states where there are Big Ten universities, they're partnering with state health departments to really focus on the social determinants of health with a health and all policies approach. The provosts of all of those institutions recognize that some of the greatest disparities in the country are in the states where Big Ten universities are. And they recognize, particularly among the land-grant institutions, that their focus, their charter back in the 1800s, was on practical academic disciplines to address issues created by changing economic conditions and social class. So the land-grant institutions, but all of the Big Ten universities, through their provosts, have recognized that they have a role to play in a health and all policies approach in terms of research, in terms of training and workforce development and policy analysis, and they need to partner with the state health departments, particularly on the analytics of the data, with all of the data that we're collecting, and on the policy analysis that really will impact a lot of the social conditions. And that's where the Federal Reserve has also really stepped up to say, we want to be part of that and really want to play collectively with you. So when you start developing partnerships, you start recognizing that there need to be more partners at the table. And that's what health and all policies is all about. It's about convening. It is, as the Surgeon General said, it's about organizing. It's organizing the people who can make a difference in changing conditions. So I'll turn it back to Paul for whatever conversation.
Sure. So we do have about 15 minutes this time to get together. Let me launch a question, and then if you have some questions to ask, please be prepared for that. So Susan, if you were a state health agency or if you were a local health agency, both of which require to do community health needs assessments, community health improvement plans, who would you approach in the financial sector if you wanted to partner?
So I think there are probably several different partners. I would invite you to approach the Fed for guidance the banks, the first bank branches that exist in your footprint and the communities you're thinking about. Every financial institution has a community reinvestment, a CRA officer, and that is probably the person that you would be put in contact with. Again, the Fed can help you find out who that person is. And I think that is the person who should engage in this discussion and hopefully get them to the table early. We always say that the community benefit agreements is like CRA at the hospital. So there might even be some thinking that can be brought in around it. CRA exams each contain what we call a performance context, so sort of understanding is exactly what it sounds like, is understanding the market conditions that exist within the place where the bank branch is located. These at this point do not include health factors, or even those that they stages of thinking about this thing. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity for discussion around those between the two sectors, really on the ground. And so just reaching out to your local financial institutions, don't be shy about walking into a branch and saying, I'm from this institution and I need to talk to this kind of person. And that should get you somewhere. If you're not, feel free to reach out to us or the state banking commissions.
That was the CYA officer, you said?
CRA.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Very good. My hearing's not so good. So. Good. Anyone have a question in the audience here, please? Sir.
Does CRA include any larger
Are these financial reports public?
Yes. So the CRA exams are all public. Probably if you have a specific financial institution that you are interested in, you can just Google, XYZ financial institution CRA exam and find out the most recent results.
Thank you. Should we repeat the question, or did you all hear it? I'll assume that means you heard it. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, for a financial institution, their area that they're measured upon is any place they have a bank, a branch, an ATM, or provide services such as loans. So it's a defined service area, whereas the hospitals, I don't believe the IRS has defined what is their service area, which I think is a real weakness.
Yeah,
in the IRS regulation of hospitals. But am I correct in that?
You are. I think you know, the financial institution with all of those pieces, you have to show that by through those pieces you are serving the entirety of your community and that you're not carving low income areas or those things. So you're covered what we call your assessment area. It's equitable. There is a CRA statute, and then there is something called CRA Q&A, and that's online. It's all available. That's under review, given the amount of online banking that's being done and sort of how banking has changed since the last time the Q&A was reviewed. And so that's something that's sort of an effort to modernize CRA in the process and also take some time.
So if you're really lucky, you get to assess the Cayman Island banks, right?
I have a question for Susan. So I know in our area, some of our people from Fed really were interested in early childhood development and have pushed a lot of resources and a lot of energy around early childhood development, particularly in the health aspect. Do Federal Reserve banks throughout the country focus on different kinds of things in terms of where they can kind of focus on public health issues in addition to the Community Reinvestment Act?
Yes, and so I think what surprised me, having been with the Fed for almost 5 years, and what still continues to surprise me is the extent to which each reserve bank is different. And so when I say wherever you're from, find out where your local branch is, get in touch with them, and find out what they're working on, because it's not sort of a response to local needs and sort of what local interests are. I'm often informed by simply us hearing from people in the community. If you feel there's something we should know, then we should do about it. For example, the Federal Reserve branch of Chicago, in addition to focusing on the community development public health intersection, we spend a lot of time obviously working in Detroit. We do a lot of work around post-industrial cities. We do a lot of work around small business funding. I think they're sort of just the buckets that we think about. Our states were disproportionately hit by the foreclosure crisis, so often remain so. And so that's something that we continue to invest a great deal of resources into, perhaps more than other banks that may focus on workforce development or other issues. It's simply how they've decided to lay out their strategic plan. We're actually in the midst of the strategic planning process, which took us to multiple meetings with people in Illinois, through Detroit, to meet with that community stakeholders. And so what we work on for the next 5 years will be informed by those discussions.
In our state, the Federal Reserve probably was the main force in pushing the discussion on early childhood development. Mm-hmm. It was a huge force.
Other questions or comments? So how many of you really understood how much the Federal Reserve was doing before you've recently come? Isn't it wonderful? And then think about all the other sectors out there who may be doing similar things. There's a question here.
Language,
Susan, you're using the word funder. So do you mean someone might approach to say, we're doing a project, a housing abatement project for asthma vectors in a low-income area. Will you fund that, or are you just talking about we have an issue with asthma here due to substandard housing? Will you bank work on the housing in that community?
So I think that we would think of almost saying the same thing, and I think it's, first of all, it's important to engage with your bank early in the process, especially if this is a new area for them to have a conversation, you know, have a coffee or something like that, and introduce what you see as there's a health need in your community. CRA is not dollars bank. It's CRA credit by doing things with
yeah.
their money or with their services. So we want to talk about CRA credit. It's not people come to us and say, how do I get CRA dollars? And we back it up and start at the beginning of that discussion. But that said, is that banks have an interest in having a market presence. And so whether there are many different ways you can structure a transaction. And I think that's also where your community development friends can be helpful, because they start thinking about layers of capital and different subsidies that exist out there and tax credits and all of those kinds of things. It can be a lot to take in, and there are people who are expert at this. So it's worth getting to know those people and understanding it and not trying to learn it all yourself. But it's also your banking partners, they may make a loan, they may make a grant, they may make an investment. We are working right now with a jobs training program in Gary, and so there's the jobs component for returning offenders, for returning citizens, and part of that is financial literacy. Part of that is helping these individuals open a bank account and making sure that when they go to their financial institution, they're not going to get turned away because they will never go again. Making sure that so there's all different ways in which you can partner with these financial institutions in which they could potentially get CRA credits.
Could I ask, have social impact bonds come up in this community at all?
Yes, and so that's something we think a lot about, so that within the context of paper success, and certainly I think that the area that is ripe for collaboration across the health and community development sectors, especially in the area of not so much here in the Midwest, but there are some great examples I know coming out of Salt Lake City and places like that where there's been significant impact in social impact bonds. So it's an interesting tool. We have one mistake on that, we'll be wrong about that, and information is quite old. But certainly it's something worth looking at and working with the partners.
Yeah, I heard from the nurse family partnerships, they're using those in some cases, some communities. Last question? Okay, well, why don't we thank our speakers, Dr. Ellinger, Steve Manuel,